It's actually shocking if you think about it. We're in the middle of a technological revolution. There's been no innovation in this space since the washer and dryer 100 years ago. And as a result, in America, we're spending 13 billion hours and $75 billion a year doing something no one wants to do. It just hasn't been a good alternative yet. We like to joke that there's three things certain in life: death, taxes, and laundry.
This multi-million dollar idea is so simple, but yet absolutely revolutionary. It'll make you think, hey, why didn't I think of that? But when Mort Fertel began telling people about his family's idea and their startup business, he was told he was crazy. It'll never, ever work. But this is the same guy you'll learn who bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok in search of something bigger. And this is the guy who left Wall Street one day for a reason that would make rabbis everywhere smile. This is a guy who just sees the world differently than just about everyone else. It's no wonder, with God's help, he is as successful as he is. Grab a sweatshirt from your laundry pile. We're going on a journey. Being a Jew? Awesome. Managing personal finances? Not so awesome. Welcome to Kosher Money. A brand new episode of Kosher Money here with Mort Fertel, our first Mort. We've never had a Mort on the podcast.
Okay, a milestone.
When someone hears the name Poplin, when I heard it first, I thought it was a massive popcorn company. But we're going to get into the whole Uber for laundry business. But I want to go back. Mort Fertel. Who is Mort Fertel? Tell us about your upbringing. Where'd you grow up? And we'll get into your business and family journey.
Sure. So I grew up outside of Philadelphia, a small town called Springfield, southwest suburbs of Philly. It's not a Jewish area. I went to the public school system there, didn't grow up in a religious family. I think I was one of maybe like seven Jews in the whole school, which had like a few thousand kids. Mm-hmm. I played a lot of sports as a kid. Like, I constantly always had a ball in my hand. Mm-hmm. And I got to be pretty good. After ninth grade, I transferred to a pretty ritzy private school on the main line outside of Philadelphia, a school that I wouldn't never have otherwise been able to go to. But I think sports helped me get there. That was a very interesting experience, actually called Episcopal Academy, which interestingly was about 20-25% Jewish. And then I graduated from Episcopal in 83 and went to Penn, just about 20 minutes away in Philly, also not far from my home.
Were you an Orthodox Jew at that point or no?
Hardly. No. We were, I guess you could say we were Reform. Mm-hmm. I went to Hebrew school for a little while. I remember playing kickball there. It's pretty much all I remember. Mm-hmm. I don't ever remember hearing about Avraham or Yitzhak or Yaakov. Mm-hmm. We didn't do a Seder. I was bar mitzvahed. Mm-hmm. It was more of a bar than a mitzvah. Mm-hmm. Cashed my checks and was liberated from Hebrew school. And really, Torah, Judaism had zero role in my life.
So at what point did you start getting exposed to Judaism? What was the
transition?
It was
much, much, much later. I was actually 29 years old, 29, 30 years old.
Oh, so you were already in the working world.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to Wharton at Penn, and I started a business there and sold the business my senior year in college. Mm-hmm. Then I went to work on Wall Street for a few years. Then I, tell me if you want me to slow
no,
down.
No, this is good.
Yeah. Then I started a direct mail advertising company. I ran that for about 5 years. I sold that. I was 29 years old at the time. That's kind of when the journey started back to Torah. As I said, I sold the business. I guess you would say I was living what others may have thought was kind of an idyllic life. But I felt that there was something missing and something not quite right. And I wasn't really sure what it was. I mean, I was a normal, healthy person. It wasn't like there was something unhealthy about me. But I just felt like there was something, must be something more to life than just this, you know, pursuit of productivity and all that. So I bought a one-way ticket to Bangkok and I started traveling around the world. And I figured I'd spend some time thinking about what that purpose to life might be.
So you had money, right?
Like it, I had some money.
You were making money, you had a good job, you were healthy, you know, you had a good family.
Yeah.
But you felt something was missing.
Yeah. Like I said, I started my first business. I was 18 years old. I franchised that to seven cities across the country. I sold it my senior year. Then I went to work on Wall Street for a few years. I kind of liked working on Wall Street. It was very exciting, but it was all about money and only money. And I know this podcast is called Kosher Money. There's nothing wrong with money. I don't mind making money. I like making money, but it was all about money. I didn't like that. I like to work and I like to make money, but I like to be doing something that I think is meaningful and is contributive to the world, making a difference in people's lives. And so I left Wall Street for that reason, and I wanted to start my own business again. I wasn't sure what it was going to do, but I found my way to this direct mail advertising company where I was helping small businesses, really helping them, you know, get new customers. And it was very meaningful for a while, and it was pretty successful. And like I said, then I sold it.
That was your second.
That was my second. In between, I actually had one or two others.
Of course you did.
But
you do have that entrepreneurial.
I'm definitely, you know, a serial entrepreneur.
Right.
I love building things. I love creating things. I love having a vision that other people can't see and making it come to reality.
I'd love to get into that, but you kind of threw me for a loop with the one-way ticket to Bangkok. Why Bangkok and why one way?
You know, I was a Jew looking for the meaning of life. Where's one supposed to go but to Asia, right?
The other part of Asia, but yeah.
So I started traveling around. I spent some time at a Buddhist monastery. Uh-huh. At the time, I don't know what it's like now, but there were a lot of other travelers, sort of spiritual seekers. So they're very fascinating people and interesting conversations. And it was really a travel of the heart more than it was a physical travel. So really a lot of deep thinking and reading. I spent a lot of time reading.
You were making money during this. You were using money that you've already made to pay for the trip. Got it.
Correct.
So it was completely outward facing. You weren't doing anything to occupy your time other than whatever it is you wanted to do at that given time.
Correct.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's a lot of, yeah.
So how long did you spend?
We went to Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore. We were traveling in Asia for about 7 months.
Who's we?
So I traveled with my girlfriend at the time,
Okay. Now
my wife.
Okay.
So when we were in Indonesia, this is an interesting part of the story. Yeah. Sure, you'll appreciate it. Many of your listeners will probably appreciate it. So we were in Indonesia. We were finished with Indonesia. We were deciding where to go next. And I said, let's go to India. So I was interested in, you know, the spirituality in India and in ashrams and gurus and all that stuff. But it was the monsoon in India. It was the bad time to go there. So Ari, my wife, she said, let's go to Israel. So I'm like, Israel? Why would we go to Israel? We're Jews looking for spirituality, you know, nothing in Israel. So, but interestingly, I shared with you a little bit about my Jewish upbringing, which was very, very minimal and very shallow and very, you know, reform. And, I described it a little bit. But my wife had a different upbringing. She had, if it's possible, even less of a Jewish experience than I did. Her parents saw right through the whole reform and conservative, you know, fashion show and all. They wanted nothing to do with it. So they had no affiliation with a synagogue, no affiliation with anything Jewish, except once a year, this guy would come to their house with his long beard and his guitar, and he would sing songs and tell stories with Shlomo Carlebach.
Wow.
So she always had this sense that there was something deep and meaningful and spiritual in Judaism. And so since the monsoon was in India, it was like, you know, we had no appointments. We had nothing. We had to, okay, so we'll go to Israel.
Think that Shlomo Carlebach had that effect.
Isn't that amazing?
Did you ever reconnect with him afterwards?
So that was 1995. He had passed away already.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it really is it's an interesting Shlomo story.
Yeah.
So we went to Israel and we learned there. And we spent Shabbos with Torah families. And it was really a life-changing experience for both of us. I saw these families. Mm-hmm. I saw Shabbos. And I'm like, yep, that's what I want.
Really?
That's
the life I want. And your wife or girlfriend at the time, were you guys in sync on that? Or it took some convincing one to the other?
No, we were in sync.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was really a journey we took together.
Got it. So you're in Israel, and then I know you spend time in Baltimore. What happened between Israel and Baltimore?
Let's see, a lot.
To the listening audience, I thought Mort lived in Utah, and he says, no, actually, we live in LA now. So, and I said, when did that happen? He said, 4 months ago. So, you know, this idea, I mean, you probably have listed 4 continents since we started speaking, about 16 different countries. So you're in Israel, you're inspired by Judaism, become Orthodox Jewish, and what happens from there? How many moves?
To hear you say that, to hear somebody else describe my life like that, it's very interesting. Yeah. It's like, it's really an adventure, isn't it?
Yeah.
Life, it's really an adventure.
I mean, figuratively and literally in your case.
Yeah, that's kind of the way we see it.
Oh, by the way, when you became an Orthodox Jew, what's the phone call like to your family or to people? Were they accepting of it? Do you tell them right away? Like, how does that conversation happen? Because it's a real life change, right? You're not hopping anymore from country to country.
Yeah.
You're now building a family, but it's not necessarily the direction that everyone you knew growing up thought you were going to be taking.
Yeah. I probably tried to explain it much more than I should have. Mm-hmm. It's really not explainable. Like, they had no point of reference. Mm-hmm. They had no context. I mean, both of our families, you know, particularly my family, I mean, just zero contact with the Orthodox Jewish community. So they had no idea. It's hard to even explain how little idea they had of like what it meant and what it was. So it was really inexplicable. In retrospect, I probably should have said a lot less, because I think over the years they started to appreciate, like, you know, the beauty in it and the values in it. Not that it was something that they would choose for themselves, and not that there weren't inconveniences for them and things that bothered them, because there certainly were. My mother was a great cook. She, she always fed us well as a child. And it was a way that a mother never stopped taking care of her children. Mm-hmm. And now my mother couldn't cook for me, you know. Just one small example that, you know, doing things on the weekends and Shabbos, it was just, you know, the inconvenience of it from their perspective was difficult.
Got it. So you eventually made your way back to the States. And, I mean, you have to get a job at some point, right? What did your career journey look like from there?
So I actually didn't get a job for a lot of years. We were, you know, living off the savings from the sale of the businesses. I was learning for about 5 years.
In Israel?
So I took, not surprisingly, as I do with most things, kind of an unconventional approach to learning. It wasn't a traditional, you know, full-time learning in yeshiva, although I did spend some time learning in yeshiva. Came back to America, we got married. We had a son, and then went back to Israel for 3 months, and I spent some time in a yeshiva there. Uh-huh. In general, the 5 years that I took learning, it was more somewhat similar to learning I was doing when I was traveling, in that it was very independent, and I was doing a lot of reading and thinking and studying, but it was Jewish sources this time. Mm. And I was really very into Jewish thought and philosophy. I could never really get into it, the Gemara learning, mm-hmm. and could never really sort of crack that code. But I still love to learn. And I love to learn Chumash and Jewish thought and philosophy, and, you know.
So I'm waiting for when the money dries up, right? So after 5 years, you had to face the reality.
Yes. It wasn't really a function of the money drying up. Okay. At some point, I wrote a book. It's called Marriage Fitness. And my wife and I had, well, I'll try to be brief here, because I know this is probably not the point of your line of questioning, but we had a son who died, and then we had twin daughters who also died. And that happened over a period of about 18 months. And it was really, really a difficult time. And as is often the cases with these kinds of losses, it threw our marriage into a bit of a crisis. We succeeded to reconcile our marriage. And more than that, we really succeeded to move our marriage to a place better than it had ever been. And we felt after we had that experience that I felt that I had some sort of responsibility to kind of share what I had experienced. And we sort of retraced what we had experienced. And by doing that, I developed what I called marriage fitness, which is an alternative to marriage counseling. I spent 9 months in a library writing all about this experience and creating this methodology. And I wrote a book. It's called Marriage Fitness. I didn't know what I had. I wasn't an author. I wasn't a therapist. I wasn't a counselor. I kind of figured I would bind a few copies for my kids and go back to doing some, like you said, finding some other way to make a living and have a career. But I thought, before I do that, let me send it around and see if anybody thinks there's anything here. So lo and behold, the book was endorsed by Stephen Covey. It was endorsed by John Gray, was picked up by the Library Journal, which anybody in the industry knows what that is. And I was on national media and television and radio. And before I knew it, I was this like international marriage guru. It was quite an experience. I ended up developing the book into an online self-help program, which became the number one marriage crisis program in the world.
What year was this?
Let's see, the book was published in 2004, developed it into an online self-help program in 2005.
So courses online weren't like super popular then,
right? I was very early. I was basically the first marriage expert online and like the first marriage program online, the first source of marriage help online. I was one of Google's first advertisers. Yeah.
So were people reaching out for marriage advice and counseling, stopping you in shul? You became a marriage expert?
So this wasn't a local thing. This wasn't local. This was all, there was no exaggeration, hundreds of thousands, millions of people reaching out online, downloading my materials, subscribing to my email lists, purchasing my courses.
A quick break from this week's episode with a message from the Donors Fund. Purim is coming, a Jewish holiday where charity is top of mind. You're going to be giving out money to those who stretch their hands out, no matter where they come from. But gone are the days where you have to hand out actual cash, crisp dollars, or carry a checkbook even. And by the way, with cash, I don't know if you know this, but you also lose out on your tax-deductible donation. But not with the Donors Fund. With the Donors Fund, you get these easy and simple custom checks. And every time you give, you're getting a tax-deductible donation. So I have these pre-printed custom checks. You can have denominations going from a dollar up to $1,800, all pre-printed, and no more fraud, right? Every time you give a regular checkout, it has your accounting number and your routing number. With the Donors Fund, you completely avoid that. And that is peace of mind. You can do something cool. You can even set a cap that any check over a certain amount, they have to verify with you before the money is released from your account. On Purim, people give, I think they say 50 to 100 times more than a typical day, right? So if you go 50 to 100 days, you're giving out X amount of money. People are giving that out in a single day. So just because the amount of money is multiplied, it doesn't mean the headache has to be multiplied as well. The Donors Fund, that is what charity giving should be in 2024 and beyond. So have your checks ready to go. You can have them pre-printed. No more sitting and writing checks. You can actually get involved in the dancing and enjoy the day while giving. So thedonorsfund.org/koshermoney, links in the show notes. It's a free account. This is free. Join the thousands of people who have already made the move and have yourself an even more Freilichen Purim. Now back to this week's episode. What's the crux? What was, you know, if you had to boil down marriage fitness into, you know, three sentences, what was resonating? I mean, it sounds like you turn this into, without intentionally doing so, a business. But, you know, people are going to now pause the episode, Google, you know, marriage fitness. What did you pick up on that resonated with so many people?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There were a few things. First of all, marriages don't improve by fixing what's wrong. They improve by making new things right. And the marriage fitness methodology gives a whole system of behaviors that create a connection between husband and wife and make new things right. when you try to go into the past to work on what's wrong, a couple actually ends up getting mired in the negativity of their situation. And very often they end up feeling worse about the marriage when they come out of the session than they did when they, you know, before they went into it. It's not a matter of right and wrong. It's all about what works for you. You know, it's like if you're trying to shoot a foul shot and you've got your elbow out here, the ball is not going to go in the hoop. It's not the way you shoot a foul shot. You shoot it with your elbow in here. And marriage is no different than anything else in the world. That is, there's a way to do it. And if a person can understand what are those principles and practices of a successful marriage and align their actions with it, they're dramatically more likely to have success. If, on the other hand, they ignore those principles and practices and just try to make it up or convince themselves that there is no right or wrong way, it's just a matter of what I want to do, so then a person's going to suffer.
Had an athlete from Philadelphia who had a stint on Wall Street and traveled through Asia suddenly picked up on these core philosophies of marriage and life.
I experienced them in my own marriage.
But people can experience things and not have the realization or the understanding of or lessons of what they just experienced. It sounds like you're almost in tune, or like you said, you go back to revisit and say, hey, why am I feeling this way? What can I do to fix it? Which is maybe why you like creating and developing businesses, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
So Marriage Fitness sounds like the book is selling. You're making some level of money. Where did that transition in your career journey? How many years did that last? And is that still available online?
Yes, it's still available and it's still lasting. And I still do it. The program is still selling online. Mm-hmm. I still do occasionally full day intensive house calls and private sessions. However, I've toned down that part of my work considerably over the last 5 years. And at this point, 99% of my time is devoted to Poplin.
So let's get into Poplin.
Yeah.
Right? Take me to that day in 2017. What happened and what did you create as a result?
So Poplin started because of one comment my wife made in 2017. She was home with our 5 kids buried in laundry. She's like, this is crazy. I can tap an app and get to the airport, FaceTime someone on the other side of the world, but I'm still doing laundry like my grandmother. And as always, she was right. Technology's transformed every aspect of our life, making it all so fast and easy, except for this chore that takes the longest and we hate the most. It's actually shocking if you think about it. We're in the middle of a technological revolution. There's been no innovation in this space since the washer and dryer 100 years ago. And as a result, in America, we're spending 13 billion hours and $75 billion a year doing something no one wants to do. It just hasn't been a good alternative yet. We like to joke that there's 3 things certain in life: death, taxes, and laundry. So Poplin solves laundry. It's beautiful. You just tap the app, take your laundry, put it outside your front door, back door, designated location, wherever that might be. And that's it. You're done. You go on with your day. You enjoy your life. Meanwhile, one of our laundry pros, and we have over 100,000 nationwide, they come, they pick up the laundry, they wash it, dry it, fold it, return it to you the next day in pristine stacks of perfectly folded laundry.
So your wife makes that comment. I'm assuming you weren't doing the laundry with her.
My 16-year-old son was in the laundry room at the time, happened to overhear the comment. Typical teenager, he's like, look, mom, not helping you with the laundry, but I think I can solve this problem for you. I'll build you an app. So we thought he was kidding. We homeschooled our kids and we taught them you can learn to do anything and you can figure it out. So he actually believed us and he went and he figured this out. He looked at what Uber was doing. And he basically built an entire tech stack that modeled Ubers. And Poplin became the Uber for laundry.
But on day one, you need people who want their laundry done and people to do the laundry.
The classic cold start problem in a peer-to-peer marketplace. Yes.
Chicken and egg.
Chicken and egg, right. So I was the first laundry pro.
And
so we didn't have to solve the supply problem. Okay. We just had to solve initially the demand problem. Now, that didn't last long, but my wife and I did some of those initial loads.
Got it. So your son, the 16-year-old, what's his name?
Nachshon.
Nachshon. So Nachshon builds the app.
Yep.
He's employee number one, or I'm sure he's
co-founder.
He's the co-founder, right?
Co-founder, yeah.
Day one comes. You're doing people's laundry. Who were the first few customers?
It's funny. We recently passed a significant milestone in the company, and we invited that day one customer onto a conference call with the whole company. It was really amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, who was it? You know, it was just
someone in Baltimore.
Yeah, we launched in Baltimore. Okay. Someone in Baltimore is the random person.
Were you spending tens of thousands of dollars on marketing day one?
No, not even close. We started out very, very small. We just placed some Google ads.
Really?
Found some people looking for laundry service. And that's how it started.
And when you thought of laundry service 10 years ago, if you wanted someone to do your laundry, you could theoretically go to a laundromat, right? Drop it off. But that's time out of your day to put it in your car, drop it off, go and pick it up. It's that on demand. Okay, so you start growing, right?
Similarly, like today, if you wanted to get to the airport, you could also pick up the phone and call a taxi.
Right.
But nobody does, because now we have this seamless, frictionless, modern experience that allows us to just quickly and easily get an Uber, and it's intoxicating. And we've done the same with laundry.
How did you know how to price it early on?
The way we priced it, I'm not saying this is the right way, but the way we priced it initially was we calculated how long it would take for the laundry pros to provide the service. We said, okay, we want them to make between $15 and $30 an hour.
Okay.
And then they're going to get 75% of the price that the customer pays. And it's just simple math from there.
Yeah. So if I'm a laundry pro and I want to go full time, which is kind of cool, right? I'm working from home, but I'm doing labor.
You tuned into it.
Does that exist? Had that existed?
Yeah. So it's a great question. So the question is, how are we getting these gig workers competing against Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, right, Instacart, et cetera? So I'll introduce you to the second problem Poplin solves. First one's obvious. People hate to do laundry. They can outsource us. But we're a two-sided peer-to-peer marketplace solving a second problem, which is that unskilled workers, people who don't sit behind a desk for a living, people who work in factories, Amazon's fulfillment center, restaurants, hospitals, they want to work from home too. But in many cases, they can't, because they don't necessarily have the skills. Or maybe they do have the skills, but they don't want to be relegated to a desk in the basement. They want to have sort of freedom in the house. But what they do have is an underutilized washer and dryer. So you combine that with the Poplin app, and voila, you have the first ever manual labor work from home gig in the world. And so at a time when the big marketplaces are actually spending a lot of money trying to recruit workers and they're losing them, we're spending like nothing, and they're coming in droves, because it's just this really unique manual labor work from home gig opportunity. Most of our laundry pros are stay at home moms who either wouldn't otherwise be working, and this gives them the opportunity to earn extra income for their family, or they'd be working, but they'd have to be out of the house, and now they wouldn't be able to be a stay at home mom. So remember, just to tie it back into, like, I love to make money, but I have to be doing it in a way that's really meaningful, that really impacts people's lives. Marriage fitness is an obvious example. There you're, you know, saving families. It's a beautiful thing. But I see the same thing in Poplin. Not that I'm saving families. That would be an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. But I don't really see it as a laundry service. I see it as we're selling the most precious thing on earth, which is a better life. And it's a better life for people on both sides of the platform. Obviously, for people who are outsourcing their laundry because they now have 2 to 4 hours a week to enjoy life rather than labor over laundry. But it's also a better life for the laundry pros because they get this opportunity to work from home that they wouldn't otherwise have.
That's kind of cool. I'm thinking as a laundry pro, you know, every time you pick up someone's laundry, I mean, my mom always found money in my pocket. Like, hey, I'm rich, right? Yeah. Like, I guess just a sub question right there is, I'm sure people find things all the time stuck in pockets. Does that happen?
Some of my favorite stories are laundry pros finding diamond rings.
Wow.
It's happened 2 or 3 times, like really expensive diamond rings. Uh-huh. Put it in a Ziploc bag. They return it with the laundry and a little note. And it becomes this whole social media story. It goes around the company. It goes around online. Oh, I mean, really? It's really beautiful.
I hope there's an option for those people to tip their laundry prep.
And they get usually a significant tip. In fact, I think one of them, if I'm not mistaken, one of them got a $999 tip. And I figured out that the reason why it was $999 is because the app has a 3-digit maximum.
Uh-huh.
They probably would have even tipped them more.
That's funny.
But my engineers, they never imagined somebody would want to tip more than $999.
Right.
Yeah.
So the person who's doing the laundry is picking up the laundry
They also, yeah.
So they have to have some
It's not 100% work from home, but
right.
Because they do have to do the pickup and delivery, but most of it's work from home.
And it's close by. You're not driving.
Yeah, you
40
set the
miles.
You set the radius.
So it's radius.
Really, you see orders come in as a laundry pro, and you can take the ones you want and reject the ones you don't. And you can see where they are.
Do you see yourself as a tech company, or do you?
We are.
How do you look at yourself?
Yeah. So Airbnb is the largest hospitality company in the world, and they don't own a room. Uber is the largest transportation company in the world, and they don't own a vehicle. Poplin is the largest laundry service company in the world. We don't own a washer, we don't own a dryer, and we don't inventory detergent. We, like them, are a tech company.
Who supplies the detergent, by the way?
Laundry Pro, yeah. Now, the customer, if you have a particular detergent that you want to use for whatever reason, you can include it with your laundry. The laundry pro will use it and then return the extra to you. But vast majority of customers just rely on the laundry pro.
Got it. So you said your son Nachshon is in the business.
Yes.
You're in the business.
Yes.
Who else is in
Moshe,
the business?
My other son Moshe. Nachshon is a triplet.
Okay.
So just tying the story together, we lost the 3 children that I told you about. And then not too long after that, God works in funny ways, we had triplets.
Wow.
Nachshon, Moshe, and Shira. And Nachshon and Moshe work with me in the company. Nachshon's my co-founder. Moshe joined a couple years later.
Got it. And then maybe I read online that Shira in the beginning was bookkeeping or?
Yes.
Right. So it was like a whole family business.
We'll be right back to our Kosher Money episode, though I want to first tell you about Sima Shmueli and her 4 children. Where are they? They've been staying in a small Tel Aviv hotel room for over 4 months, and they've had enough. They want out. She's ready to risk going home despite the shelling by Hezbollah, despite the sirens going off at all hours of the day and night in her hometown, and despite the fact that her husband, a reserve officer in the Israeli army, is away in Gaza fighting Hamas. Sima and her kids are just one of 16,000 families that are now heading home to their ravaged communities in Israel's northern and southern borders. They were forced to flee after October 7th, becoming refugees in their own country. And these refugees are returning home to neglected apartments, empty refrigerators, and to the inevitable damage that happens when you run for your life and forget to shut the windows. Home sweet home, no. More like home bittersweet home. And Kol Chabad is stepping up to the plate to help the families restock their pantries, purchase the necessary cleaning supplies, and repair damages sustained in the attacks of October 7th. Plus, there's no husband and father in many cases to help with the work and the bills. So give what you can, literally any amount, to help Sima and families just like hers build back their home. kolchabad.org/koshermoney. Link is in the show notes. Give whatever you can, and God bless you. Now back to this week's episode. There are a few different ways we can carry this conversation. We can lean more into Poplin itself, and I probably have like more nuanced questions. Let's talk about Poplin as a business, right? Scaling up that business. Some people are able to start a business and take it to a certain point, but then building past their comfort zone or hiring 100, 200 people in the office investing deeper into it once you have some level of profitability. You know, you are in a more rare circumstance, especially for an Orthodox Jew. You raised money, so you got additional capital pushed in, which you, I don't know necessarily if you had to, right? I'm sure there was some portion of the business that was running quite well, but you wanted to make it better. Was that scary? I know you're going to say like, no, I love it. I'm not comfortable just creating and building, but I think that's rare. People sometimes freeze once they have some level of success and they say, okay, I'm able to pay my bills. I'm good. I don't need this to go worldwide. I don't need to go bigger. So how do you look at all of that?
If one's in a business that's doing well and they're saying that they don't need to go bigger and they don't need to go worldwide, I think that could be fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Different business people have different interests and goals, and that's fine. I think it's important for a person to know themselves and to understand their family situation and to be clear on what am I trying to achieve here and why. And who am I? Like, you know, as a career person, like what makes me tick? You know, I mean, you can see I'm a serial entrepreneur, right? I could never work for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And add to that, the fact that I did marriage fitness for 20 years and I'm still doing it is like a minor miracle. I mean, I get bored very quickly, very easily. I like new challenges. I like to build things. I like to create things. But that's me. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that, you know, I know that that's me. My point here is I think it's important that a person knows themselves. And if somebody has a nice business and it's earning a nice income and, you know, it's local or it's small and they're happy with that, it's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, there is one thing to be aware of in that situation, and that is that if you're in a business like Poplin, there's some businesses where it's like winner take all. There's a market. The one who first wins that market is likely to win the whole market and dominate it. It's important that a person be aware that they are not in that kind of business. So let me give you an example. Peer-to-peer marketplaces, there are tremendous network effects. The network effects make it such that the one that is there first and the one that gets scales first is the one that's going to own the market. And once you own it, nobody else is going to be able to get in.
Is that like Uber?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like if you think about Uber right now, Uber had Lyft all of these years, but that was kind of a unique situation. We're probably not worthwhile to get into the details there. But you notice now what's happening, that Uber is getting bigger and becoming profitable. Lyft is losing a lot of steam. Right? That's not accidental. I like to ask people, like, name for me Airbnb's biggest competitor. Some people will be able to give an answer, but most people like you shake their head or finally come up with like, right? It's a trick question. The point is there is no real competitor, right? And that's because at this point, Airbnb is so established. They have it would be foolish for anybody to try to compete. So you have to be careful you're not in this kind of business. If you're in this kind of business, and you try to make the decision to stay small, you're going to get crushed. Mm. Now, most businesses aren't like that. Most businesses don't have that network effect dynamic that make it such that it's winner take all. But it's just important to be aware of, because if you are in that kind of business and you're trying to make a decision to like keep it as a small family business or a lifestyle, it's not going to work. Like if you're successful, somebody's going to see that. Somebody's going to scale beyond you and you're going to get crushed.
So that, I suppose, was your impetus, your itch to keep this growing.
Exactly. Interesting. That's the answer to the question you alluded to before, which is why did we raise money? About 2 years ago, we raised $10 million seed round. And why did we do that? Because I realized what the nature of the business was. And yeah, it's winner take all. It's a huge, huge opportunity. We're by far the leader in the market. We have the opportunity to really hit a big, big home run here. But it's going to take money to do that, much more money than I have.
We haven't really done an episode on investments, but I think just because you brought it up, let's spend a couple of minutes on that. For someone that has a business, they've shown some levels of success. A, when did you know it was time to raise money? And B, how does somebody, assuming they have no experience in that space, how do they even go about it responsibly?
In terms of how and when I realized that we needed to raise money, it was when I started to become aware of what I just explained to mm-hmm. you and the audience. It may have sounded like when I just explained it, it may have sounded like it was like second nature and it's just isn't right. this obvious. But no, it wasn't, probably wasn't obvious to many of the listeners, and it wasn't obvious to me. It's a matter of just sort of sensitizing yourself to the nature of different business communities and the specific business that I was in.
Meaning you could have done it 2 years earlier than that. What was about that moment in time? Did someone knock on your door and say, we need to infuse capital now if we want to strike?
So it's a couple of things. One I just mentioned, which is just the realization that I'm uh-huh. in that kind of business and needed that capital. The second is we had traction. We had product market fit. We developed an MVP in Baltimore. It was successful. We scaled it nationwide. You know, we're now in 500 markets, 8,000 zip codes, 48 states. You know, we're the largest laundry service company in the world.
At any given time in your head, you can just hear the washing machines going, right?
Yeah.
Right? That's awesome.
Yeah. So you're not going to be able to raise money without, you have to have product market fit. You have to prove that you've got something here that is scalable. So that was the second thing that occurred. First was the realization that I better get some money and like grow this fast and win that market. And the second was that by the time I realized that, we had proved product market fit and we had already scaled to some extent and proven that we just needed more money to scale even further.
So now you realize you need the money. Is Mort Fertel calling up his closest wealthy friends and saying, hey, would you like to invest? Or there's a more formal way of going about raising capital?
It depends on what stage the company is at. You know, we were a seed stage company, early stage company. There's a number of ways to do it. We raised from 5 VCs. And we also raised from about 20 angel investors. Many of those angel investors were friends or friends of friends.
So good word of mouth.
So yeah.
Got it.
So it also depends on how much you want to raise and who your network is. It's not uncommon for at a seed stage for people not to go to any VCs. Depending on how much you want to raise and who you know, you could probably raise a few million dollars just from your network. We raised a $10 million seed round. It would be pretty unusual to raise that much money from a network. And it's hard to get to those VCs. It's not easy. Well, especially today. When we were raising, the market was much, much better. Today, to try to raise money, good luck. It's a very, very tough market.
So the day the $10 million comes through, is that exciting or is that...
Oh, yeah, we had a big party.
Big party. But that party lasts one day, right? Like, you got to get to work the next day, right?
1 hour.
One hour, right?
That's right.
You know, like, just because you're able to see the valuation of the company go up, your responsibility now goes up 100x,
100%.
Right? So you get the money. I'm sure you knew where you needed to deploy that capital. Where did you want to invest into the company? What were you looking to hire on the technology side? Was it marketing? Where were you interested in deploying that
capital?
Exactly.
Those two spots.
Those two.
Yeah. To build the tech team
and
to invest in marketing.
Why? I mean, you had the technology. What were you looking to better that you didn't have the first few years of the company on the tech side?
Product velocity.
What does that mean in English?
That means we're a tech company. The faster you can evolve the tech product, the more successful you're going to be.
So more features,
exactly.
More
features, more testing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Got it. Cool. And then on the marketing side, that means getting into more zip codes, more awareness. I mean, I live in Long Island. I haven't seen too many. Maybe it's not in the zip codes that I'm in. And I do want to get into that. If someone does have cleaning help at home, I once said to my wife, I said, we got to look at the numbers, right? Is paying someone to come to our house and clean, and spend 4 hours a day doing laundry? Are we better off just outsourcing that?
Yes.
Oh, we are. Okay. which is kind of cool.
But you'll still need the person to clean your house.
Right.
But it's probably not good use of your money to have them also be doing the laundry.
So now you're speaking to me, right? Like, yeah. You know, there is money that is allocated, thank God, to cleaning help. But are we doing ourselves a disservice by, could be 4 out of 8 hours is spent on laundry.
Exactly.
And is that money well spent?
Exactly.
Mortford tells us now.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So
plus your cleaning help might not be a laundry pro. In other words, our laundry pros are not just doing a task that you would otherwise do for yourself. They're real pros. Like doing laundry is actually a craft. Mm-hmm. When you get your laundry back from Pomplin, you feel like you just went shopping. You feel like this folding, like how did they do this? You know, it's not just that the laundry got clean. It's like, it's an experience. It's this magical experience of like getting fresh laundry back with the tap of a button. You know,
you describe it as if like Apple released the new iPhone, I mean, you know, like you're certainly passionate about it. So you get the money and what did you want to do on the marketing side that you couldn't before you had the money?
New channels of customer acquisition.
So is that programmatic advertising? Is that printed mailers? What?
Yeah. So what got us to that point was basically just Google Ads. Uh-huh. And we wanted to open up new channels of customer acquisition. So for example, paid social, Facebook ads, TikTok ads, Pinterest ads, programmatic advertising, geo-targeting advertising, direct mail, television, radio. I mean, right? There's a long list. And it costs money to test these, to optimize them, and then to scale them. Scale the ones that are successful, of course. You prune the ones that are not. It's time. It's time. It's money, and it's expertise. Right? You don't want to just, you know, you don't want to just like open up a Facebook account and try to figure out how to do Facebook advertising. Like, you know, it'll take you forever. And who says that's your expertise? I mean, you want to bring somebody in who, like, they've done this before, and you want to give the company the best chance of succeeding at these channels, which means bringing in real people with real domain expertise.
When someone's building a business, some of the questions that pop up is, do I outsource that or do I hire and build something in-house? It sounds like for the tech, you sort of built that in-house, though the marketing, you do have some level of marketing, but to expedite the expertise component of things, you outsource some of that.
Yeah, that's always a really difficult question and challenge in the development of every company. Usually, you know, the earlier stage, the more the founders are doing themselves, just because they don't have the resources, they don't have the money, they haven't experienced the growth, and they don't have the cash flow. And so there's really no option. It's either you do it yourself or it doesn't get done. And then as a company grows, like that's one of the challenges of the founders is making decisions about what are we going to continue to do? What expertise are we going to bring in? And there's all sorts of challenges there. The challenge of being, you know, can you successfully identify people that are really good at this? It's hard, especially if it's something that you're not good at or don't have any expertise in. You know, how do you vet these people? Another challenge founders often have is letting go. When you do it yourself, you're in control. It's done the way you want it to be done. But you start bringing in other people, it's not going to be done the way you want it to be done. And if you try, that's called micromanagement, and people are going to be exiting the company, you know, left and right. So you're asking a question that's not possible to give a simple answer to. It's a very complex dynamic that a founder has to navigate. There's no right or wrong way. It's every company journey is unique.
How many employees right now?
About 100.
And then how many laundry pros?
Over 100,000.
Wow. Are there laundry pros, like the best of the best?
Yeah, there are, sure, for sure.
Really?
Yeah, for sure.
and then like they're in high demand. People want them.
Well, they're not only in high demand, but they're, you know, they've been, yeah, they're doing it the most, you know, they're doing it full time. I mean, our top laundry pros are making over $5,000 a month.
Really?
Register that. $5,000 doing laundry from home.
And
pretty amazing.
And some of that time while it's cycling, they could be making money doing something else, right? It's like when you're doing laundry, only a portion of that is folding.
Yes. So if you're doing it part-time and you've got, you know, a couple of active orders a day, so yeah, when the laundry is in the dryer, you're waiting for it to be done. And in the meantime, you're with your kids, you're doing yoga, like whatever. But for the ones that are doing it full-time, making $5,000 a month, when the laundry for client X is in the dryer, I'm folding the laundry for client Y. You know, I mean, there's no downtime. Yeah, they're not making $5,000. You know, they're working hard.
Wow. A short, cool break from this week's episode to tell you about the weather. The weather? Yes, the weather. Warmer months are ahead. And that's the perfect segue into Twillery's Air Suit. You see, I'm wearing the blazer, comes with matching pants. But you know when you're wearing a traditional suit and it's kind of hot outside, you begin to sweat. But those days are gone with the Twillery Air Suit. They have this cooling mesh fabric that's commonly found in sportswear, and it's upscaled, retailored for use in this air suit. So it functions like their other suits and blazers. It has that extreme stretch, comfort, no wrinkles, plenty of pockets. And it's machine washable. So if you are dry cleaners, turn this off. This is not for you. But if you hate paying money and you want suits in different colors, lengths, long, short, regular, variety of sizes, and you want free shipping and returns, I have some good news for you. Promo code CHAI, C-H-A-I. That's $18 in Hebrew, twillery.com/koshermoney. No reason you can't be comfortable, relaxed, cool during the summer and spring months. You're welcome. Twillery.com/koshermoney, promo code CHAI. They're pretty amazing. Lots of colors, by the way. Okay, cool. Now back to this week's episode. Are some of these laundry pros, do you think, buying more washer and dryers to facilitate a legitimate?
It's not a frequent use case, but it does happen.
Right.
Because yeah, we have a couple that have like banks of washers and dryers really? In their basement. Yeah. We also have some that use laundromats and have a special relationship with the laundromat where they get discounted rates, but it's not a common use case. Generally speaking, our laundry pros are stay-at-home moms.
Stay-at-home. It's so incredible that there are marketplaces waiting to be tapped into with these gig workers and people in need of a service, and they don't even realize it yet. So anyone who has Uber Eats sees that they're moving into the grocery space and they're doing, you know, they're trying to add more. As you said, Uber's not resting on its laurels, but growing, right? You look at an app like Swimply, where they have initially the renting, you can rent out your swimming pool, and then lo and behold, tennis courts pop up and pickleball courts. You thinking about Poplin as laundry, what's next? Is it dry cleaning, right? Like where do you transition to something like this? And, you know, is it crazy to think that Poplin is a public company one day on the current trajectory?
It's not crazy at all. In fact, it's, yeah, I mean, it's not crazy at all.
Feel free to break news.
Yeah, no, there's no news, but, yeah. But I mean, at the current trajectory, there's no reason why we couldn't, you know, do an IPO or have a significant exit, you know, in 3 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. But in terms of your question about like other verticals or other spaces, we have ideas, but nothing that we're actively working on or spending time on. We believe, despite the success we've had, we believe we're still at the very, very, very early stages of this journey. And that this market is so big, the opportunity is so big, that we've got a good 3 to 7 years of just focusing on laundry. I mean, there's 125 million households producing 50 pounds of nonstop laundry every single week. That's a $300 billion market that's in the US alone. And that's even before you count SMBs, small, medium-sized businesses, which are also using us. So there's so much work to do just on, you know, just with laundry. And we're so at the early stages of it that it's not a question that we're, you know, actively trying to answer.
Right. That makes sense. And this is US based only for now.
So far,
right.
We're planning this year to launch in Canada.
Right. Last I checked, every country has laundry.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, there's no reason why, you know, I mean, Canada is this year, but, you know, over the next few years, we don't have immediate plans, but I would imagine over the next few years, we'll expand to Europe and Asia.
Right, right.
There's no reason why it can't work there.
Yeah, I mean, Uber Eats doesn't exist in Israel, but Wolt exists, or whatever they're calling it. Get exists. It's the Uber in Israel. So, yep. You know, so long that there are humans there in need of clothing, and that clothing needs to, you know, I guess what would put you out of business if someone develops clothing that doesn't have to be cleaned, but 5,000 years in, it's yet to happen.
Yeah.
That's cool. And that question sort of comes into play for other businesses in that people sort of get bored with the current revenue or the vertical that they're playing in. And they say, you know what, if I added this to my business, or if we started taking on, you know, this type of client, offering them this new service, you know, and we branch out, you know, maybe it's a little bit more stimulating for the business, you know, exciting, but that can sometimes be the wrong decision for a business to run after new money in a new space when they've yet to tap or finish tapping out their current market.
Yeah.
Right. It's very interesting. This was operating during COVID?
It was.
I'm sure that was a concern for people who were Lysoling their clothing after coming back from the supermarket. You know, this is taking clothing from someone's house, bringing it into your own house. Was that, I would think if I was a betting man, that's a real hurdle for the business.
So COVID, I mean, COVID, of course, was the horrible thing for the world.
Right.
But COVID actually helped us.
How so?
Because Poplin is no contact. There's no contact. The customer takes the laundry, they put it at their designated pickup location, which is outside their home. Mm-hmm. For example, their back door, front door, side patio, whatever. And then the laundry pro comes and picks it up. There's no contact between the customer and the laundry pro. Laundry pro takes it back to their homes, washes, dries it, folds it, returns the next day to that same designated location. Again, there's no contact. So the communication occurs through the app, through the messaging in the app. And so everybody felt safe. And it also helped us because people weren't wearing suits and ties to work anymore. They're working from their pajamas. It's more laundry, less dry cleaning.
Right.
And thirdly, it helped us because everybody wanted to work from home. And as I mentioned earlier, we offering the first and only manual labor work from home gig in the world.
Nowadays,
so for those three reasons, we thrived during COVID.
Nowadays, more and more clothing is less and less dry clean, mm-hmm. right? The shirt I'm wearing from Twillery, sponsor, but the vest I'm wearing, 10 years ago, this would have went to the cleaners once a week, once every 2 weeks, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And now that sort of benefits Poplin. That's more laundry, right? That
exactly.
50 pounds a week of laundry may have been 40 10 years ago.
Yep.
So that's interesting. So one of the projects that I started working on were shidduch video resumes. So people get a resume of somebody that's going to get married or looking for a match paper. So we said, let's create video resumes. We open up a studio. We're doing it for free for now for people. We just did this past Sunday. We had a studio for 12 hours. People came. I interviewed them for 30 minutes. We're going to cut it down to 3-minute video. They get the video. When I announced that I'm doing this, I promise you 50 people reached out. I posted it to my WhatsApp status. 50 people said, you're crazy. This is why it's not a good idea. This is why it's going to fail. This is why what you're doing is wrong morally. You know, and at one point I just said, you might be right, but I'm doing this anyway. Like this is what I think can help people get more yeses for dates. I think it shares people's personalities in a way that a paper resume doesn't. And I think you can tell where I'm going with this question. When you created Marriage Fitness, when you created Poplin, formerly known as SudShare, mm-hmm. your 40 other businesses that you've created, and I'm sure it happens on a micro level with ideas, the initial reaction from people is many a times, that's a bad idea.
What's your mentality when you hear that? Do you address that? Do you explain to them why you think it's a good idea? Or do you sort of say, okay, hold on to that, but I'm doing this anyway, and let's talk in 6 months, let's talk in 6 years?
Such a great question. It really is, because there are some companies that really do change the world. And if those entrepreneurs had waited for people to tell them that this was a great idea, it would have never happened. If it's obviously a great idea, it's unlikely that the opportunity is still available. Let me put it to you another way. I get very nervous when people love my ideas. When we started SudShare, Poplin, formerly SudShare, we started the company. Almost everybody told us we were crazy. Nobody liked the idea. Are you out of your mind, Mort? Nobody is going to give their laundry to a stranger. That's what everybody said. Nobody is going to give their laundry to a stranger. Here we are.
People will, in fact, give their laundry to a stranger.
And so will the people who said that. They might have to wait for their cousin or their friend or their mother to do it first, but we'll get to them. I mean, I remember when I was in New York City with my wife, like 15 years ago, something like that. Yeah, about 15 years ago. And it was raining. We couldn't get a cab. So I think I heard of this thing called Uber, the car. I said to my wife, are you out of your mind? I am not getting in the car with some stranger. I'm not doing it. Now today, right? I mean, Uber is one of the most frequently used app on my phone. I wouldn't dream of calling a taxi, right? Airbnb, what are you crazy? You're going to go sleep in someone's house? Or you're going to rent out your... Yeah, you must be out of your mind. These are the best ideas. And the fact that people think it's crazy and will never work means that you'll have a head start. Nobody else is going to compete with you, at least in the short term, until you're successful. And by then, if it's a marketplace, it's too late. You won. Mm-hmm. So the best feedback you can get as an entrepreneur is you're crazy, because you're right. It's the crazy ones that change the world. And the people who see the world as it is, well, that's what they're going to continue to get, the world as it is. But it's those people that have a vision for a new world that nobody else can see, those are the ones that change the world. Now, it depends. If your father owned a pizza shop and you want to own a pizza shop and you move to a different place than your father is and you open a pizza shop, okay, there's nothing new about it, nothing wrong with that, right? But people are not going to tell you you're crazy. You're opening a pizza shop. There's hundreds of pizza shops. Your father was a pizza shop owner. You'll be so, okay, that's not what I'm talking about here. We're not just talking about starting a business. We're talking about starting something that's never been done before. By the way, and in a case not obvious, that's what I love to do.
Right.
I could never start a business that already exists.
Right.
I love to, you know, I mean, same thing when I started Marriage Fitness. Wait, I don't understand. You mean you want to go get your marriage license? No. You want to go become a marriage? No, I don't want to be a marriage counselor. Are you a marriage therapist? No. Are you a writer? No. Did you go to even liberal? No, I went to Wharton. I don't get it.
Right.
You're writing a book. How are you doing this? Watch me. Because at the end of the day, what those people that need marriage help want is they want answers. They want solutions. And at the end of the day, they don't care where it comes from as long as it works. And what I developed there works. And people wanted it. And they told their friends about it. And they wrote online about it. And they don't care what your credentials are.
I guess now's a bad time to ask you to invest in my pizza shop. But no. Okay, cool.
Nothing wrong with a pizza
shop. Yeah. What didn't I ask you? What didn't we cover? First of all, are there any books that you would recommend people read? Anything that you've enjoyed? Because you are an avid reader, so I'm putting you on the spot. Whether business, finance, laundry related, anything that stands out to you as something that you would recommend to others?
So this is really going to date me. And if my kids end up listening to this, they'll laugh. But Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. It's an old book, but it's a really important book. We should all read it and really you know, really take to heart the principles that he's teaching there. I believe that he was one of the greatest thinkers of the modern era.
It's funny. I see that on people's like top 10 lists. And I'm like, no, I read Dale Carnegie and that one always follows, you know, but I've never actually read it. So I will, I'll drop it in the show notes for people. So this is a personal finance show. We like to do career journeys. It inspires people. I'm sure, by the way, you're going to get quite a bit of feedback. Is there a good way to reach you if someone does have a follow-up question, a LinkedIn profile, an email address, the contact form on Poplin's website? Is there a good way to contact you?
The best way to contact me is probably through my LinkedIn profile.
Okay. And given that it's a personal finance show, I always like to pick the guest's brain, right? Whether through your upbringing, your outlook on how you see the world now, what advice would you give to people as it relates to money?
The first piece of advice is to read a phenomenal book called The Psychology of Money.
Oh, love it.
Yeah. Isn't that great? Yeah.
He said he would come on the podcast January, February.
Really?
But I think he got a little bit busy. He just put out another book. So I reached out to him last week.
Yeah.
Morgan.
What's his
Housel,
name again? Yeah.
Morgan Housel. Yeah. Phenomenal, right?
Great book.
It sits on my night table.
Yeah. Great, great book. Very important to read.
And he does it in story form. So it's interesting.
Important to have our kids read it.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
And the second thing would be to follow the advice in the book.
Easier said than done, right?
It is. It is. But there's real MS. There's real truth there. And really, really, really good advice. Somebody once told me that they thought it was a good idea, that they try very hard to keep their wants in line with their income. I think that's good advice. I think that's very good advice.
As people's income grows, their wants tend to grow as well, right?
So that's another piece of advice somebody once gave me that I thought was great, which is, as your income grows, your spending shouldn't grow. Your savings should grow. And I try to impress upon my kids, for me, money is freedom. Not freedom in the sense of Pesach and spiritual, you know, that, you know, Mitzrayim and freedom. That's not what I'm talking about. That's you can have a rabbi in for that conversation. So that's not the kind of freedom I'm talking about. But what I mean is that money is freedom, meaning that if you can nurture your financial life to the point where you have enough money that you control your own destiny, you control your time. You may choose to work, but you don't need to work. Right? Money in the bank gives you freedom. And you might say, freedom to do what? What do you want to do? Do you want to start a business? Do you want to retire? Do you want to go on vacation? Do you want to, you know, that's the point. It's like, I don't have to work. So I think it's a good idea as we advance in our careers and make more money. I mean, of course, I'm exaggerating a little bit, right? Of course, we should also spend money in a way that brings enjoyment to life. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you make more money, you're going to treat yourself more often and spend more. But it doesn't have to be one-to-one.
Right.
I don't think we should spend every dollar, extra dollar that we make. The more we're able to save, the more freedom from money that we're able to have.
Are your kids receptive to that when you educate them, or takes
some
time?
More than others,
right?
It's a bit of a personality thing, right? There are people that seem to be somewhat genetically wired to spend, and others that are somewhat genetically wired to save. But nonetheless, I think it's important messaging. And even the ones that are more genetically wired to spend, I think I end up influencing.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, look, they're adults. Well, one's still a child, but the four oldest are, you know, adults, and they're going to make their own choices now.
Right.
That's another thing I'd like to share, which I think a lot of people probably disagree with me on this, but for those of us that do have some money, I think the worst thing you can do is give it to your kids.
Hmm. What happens if you give it to the kids?
Then they don't really ever understand how to manage it, how to make it, what the value of it is, what it means to struggle. And I think those are good, healthy things that a person should. Now don't misunderstand. If when I pass, God willing, many years from now, I hope to be able to leave to my kids. But I grew up in a lower middle income family. We didn't have a lot of money, and in a way, I kind of wish that I could have raised my kids similarly. Mm. I think it's difficult for kids to grow up in a wealthy family, and I think it behooves families that are wealthy to try to moderate their lifestyle. I mean, there's many reasons for that. The higher we live, the more pressure we put on the people around us to try to keep up with our lifestyle, which is not so sensitive to those around us. It's a lot of pressure. And for people who don't have the financial wherewithal to keep up, it doesn't feel so good. And they sometimes make foolish decisions to make it appear as though they're keeping up, mm-hmm. which just makes their financial situation worse. So for us to sort of moderate our lifestyle so as not to put so much pressure on them, and also for us to moderate our lifestyle so that our kids don't grow up having this expectation that this is the way they have to live. They may not be able to. I don't think it's so healthy for them to just be given it. And then they, yeah. I mean, one of the greatest experiences for a person is to be able to feel like I'm succeeding. If I have a family, that I'm supporting my family,
right?
And I'm working hard to do that. It wasn't just given to me. So I think ironically, sometimes when we give our kids money, we actually are taking away from them the opportunity to earn something more valuable than money.
Wow. Well said. It's something to think about. You really don't think about money that is given without strings attached that might come with a chain, right? Like that they're being held down, not allowing them to actually grow. So this has been super insightful. I'm sure we can do a round two sometime. Mort from LA. Via Utah, Baltimore, and various countries across Asia, Europe, and beyond. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you taking the time, sharing so much with us. I enjoyed it tremendously. This was like a personal TED talk, but the Mort talk. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And just like that, another episode in the books. My thanks to Mort Fertel for joining us in studio. Speaking of studio, our next episode may not actually be in the studio, and then our next episode after that might be in a brand new studio. I mean, not might, it will, God willing. It's finished. It's awesome. Can't wait for you to see it. We've been working very hard. Shout out to my brother, Yaakov Langer, for making that a reality. Thank you, Hashem. TYH Nation. Thank you to my friends at Twillery. Wearing their shirts, I'm wearing their suits, their pants, their jackets, blazers. They've got everything. Link in the show notes for first-time users. Get $18 off your $139 or more purchase. Thank you to my friends at The Donors Fund, thedonorsfund.org/koshermoney. Charity the way it should be in 2024. It's a free account. More and more people are signing up. Be one of us. And thank you to the kind anonymous sponsor out in California who encourages us each and every week to tell you about Kolel Chabad. Give what you can to this incredible organization, the longest lasting nonprofit in Israel. Thank you to our friends at Living Smarter Jewish. If you need financial help, I've said it once, I'll say it a million times. Head to livingsmarterjewish.org, click on the contact tab, or just email them info@livingsmarterjewish.org. Hi, my name is so and so. I need help with blank as it relates to my finances. And let them help you. You'll set up a 15-minute free intro call. They'll get on the phone with you, understand what your issues, challenges, hurdles, aspirations are, and help you get there at no charge. How amazing is that? Look them up. Tell them your friends at Kosher Money sent you. Every time I finish an outro these days, I finish with a tip. So I'm going to tell you about some of the apps that I have on my phone in no specific order. By the way, I don't have notifications on. When you call me, I got a notification. WhatsApp, no notifications. Now, granted, I do check it too much, but I don't understand how anyone has notifications. It is a busy world. It's a distracting world. I actually downloaded Poplin. This is not an ad, but I did want to test it out. So we gave them 3 bags of laundry today because my dryer broke. And I said, maybe let's not buy a dryer right away. Let's see how this goes. So, yeah, I don't even have a promo code for you. Sorry. Okay, what other apps do I have? ChatGPT. I use GPT-4. It's like $21 a month. I love it. Now, obviously, you have to get use out of it. Like I said in my previous outro, I have an AI tips and tricks group, a WhatsApp group. You can email me and I can send you a link to it. Which social platforms do I have? I have Twitter, YouTube. I pay for YouTube Premium, so I don't see any ads on YouTube, but that's really, I don't really watch Netflix or anything like that. YouTube is for when I want to zone out. And yeah, I do have the Starbucks app, and Naftali Horowitz would not be too happy with that, but I'm not telling you to have that app, but I'm trying to cut back a little bit. See, I'm human. People watch these episodes and they go, oh, Kosher Money, why are you doing such and such? And I tell them, I'm not perfect, right? I listen, I sit here, I'm trying to get better, but I am human, believe it or not. Unlike Mark Zuckerberg. Just kidding. Haha, I know you're watching. Okay, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Living L'chaim.